WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Robert Duvall. We'll talk about his role in the Godfather films as the legal advisor to the Corleone family, and about speaking the most famous line in Apocalypse Now. And we'll hear about his new film, A Family Thing. Some of the work seen and heard in The Godfather and Apocalypse Now was done by a man who doesn't want you to take special notice of his work. We'll talk with film editor and sound designer Walter Murch. He won an Academy Award for his sound design of Apocalypse Now. He'll give us a demonstration of how he layers sound. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. With the deadline for filing federal tax returns only hours away, Congress is set to look at a controversial proposal that would require a two-thirds vote in both houses to pass a tax increase. Republicans hope the vote will demonstrate how serious they are about lowering taxes and shrinking the government, but opponents insist that making it more difficult to raise taxes will make it even harder to balance the budget. Israel's offer to a conditional ceasefire to end 5 days of cross-border attacks has been refused by Lebanon's Hezbollah guerrillas, raising new fears of further escalation in fighting. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Beirut.
Hezbollah political leaders said rocket attacks on settlements in northern Israel will continue until Israel stops its military campaign in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah guerrillas launched fresh Katyusha rocket attacks for a fifth straight day. Israeli planes circled the skies over Beirut, drawing heavy anti-aircraft fire from Lebanese army positions. Yesterday, Israeli warplanes rocketed a power substation outside of Beirut, cutting electricity to some neighborhoods in the capital. And another Israeli airstrike damaged a building in southern Beirut, which housed the Shura, or Consultative Council of Hezbollah. 6 people were reported wounded. Lebanese Shiite Muslim leader Nabi Berri of the rival Amal party said Israel was using Hezbollah attacks as a pretext to invade Lebanon. I'm Suni Khalid in Beirut.
President Clinton is on his way to Asia, where he'll meet with the leaders of South Korea and Japan. The president says he's optimistic about chances for improving relations between North and South Korea, despite recent heightened tensions. During his 3-day stay in Japan, Mr. Clinton is expected to reaffirm the U.S.-Japanese security alliance. Later in the week, the president attends a summit in Russia dealing with threats to nuclear safety. A powerful tornado that tore across northern Arkansas last night is being called the deadliest storm to hit the state in nearly 10 years. Authorities say 7 people were killed, more than 30 hurt. Ray Bigler with the State Office of Emergency Services says the fatalities occurred at a mountain campground occupied by tourists.
This particular storm, the fatalities were in a resort area along the White River, about 5 to 7 miles north of Mountain View, Arkansas, which is the home of the Arkansas Folk Festival or Folk Center. And they are making preparations for the 35th annual Folk Festival there in Mountain View to be conducted this weekend. And a lot of out-of-state and tourist people that were in the area.
The tornado knocked out power to more than 3,000 homes. Roofs were damaged and hundreds of trees were uprooted. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 31.79 at 5564.38, volume 150 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up 7.75 points. You're listening to NPR News. The Supreme Court today agreed to hear a dispute in Idaho over control of waterways within an Indian reservation. The court said it will hear arguments by Idaho officials that federal courts lack the authority to decide such a dispute between the state and Coeur d'Alene tribe. The tribe sued the state and a number of state officials in federal court in 1991, claiming ownership of Lake Coeur d'Alene and several rivers within the tribe's reservation in northern Idaho. The 100th running of the Boston Marathon is scheduled to get underway at this hour. Mark Deegan of member station WBUR has a preview.
Because it's the 100th running of the marathon, more than 38,000 runners are registered for today's race. That's about 4 times as many as last year. With that many people on the course, it's expected to be a slower race than in years past, but race director Guy Morse says that hasn't discouraged participants.
To run this course, which has seen 100 years of athletic competition, the very best in the world have competed here. It's a real unique situation to be able to run with the world's best in the same race that they're competing in.
In the men's division, Cosmas Ndedi of Kenya is looking to become the first person to win 4 consecutive Boston Marathons. In the women's division, Germany's Uta Pippig, who set the women's course record in 1994, is looking for her 3rd straight victory. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Deegan in Boston.
Some 6,000 union workers at a GM assembly plant in Lordstown, Ohio, walked off the job today to protest the firing of their shop chairman. The auto company says it fired Al Ali because he improperly clocked out. Ali says he's clocked out the same way for 20 years. Ali has been the union local's top contract negotiator since being elected shop chairman in 1976. The European Commission today rejected an early lifting of the worldwide ban on British beef. The Commission is waiting for more information on efforts to wipe out mad cow disease. The Commission, which is the 15-nation executive body, imposed the ban last month. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Jones News Retrieval, an online service where business finds answers. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor Robert Duvall has made his mark starring in epic movies and in intimate dramas. He was Tom Hagen, the Corleone family lawyer in The Godfather. And in Apocalypse Now, he played the macho Colonel Kilgore. In The Great Santini, he was a rigid Marine pilot who imposed a strict discipline on his family. In Tender Mercies, he played a country music singer on the skids, living a quiet life with a widow and her son. On TV, he starred in the Western miniseries Lonesome Dove. Now he's starring in A Family Thing. Duvall plays Earl Pilcher, a man who has spent his whole life in rural Arkansas. When his mother dies, she leaves him a letter explaining that she's not his real mother. His birth mother was an African-American who was raped by Earl's father and died giving birth to Earl. Earl heads north in search of his half-brother, played by James Earl Jones. This is the scene in which they meet.
My name's Earl Pilcher. I know who you are. What do you want from me?
How do you know who I was?
I just know. What do you want from me?
My mother wanted me to look you up.
Are you trying to be funny?
No, not at all.
No, sir.
See, my mother just passed on 4 or 5 days ago. She left me a letter. Crazy story about you and me. your mom and my daddy and some stuff. I don't know why she wanted me to look you up, but she did. So I did.
I know the story. I know all about it. I know all about your sorry daddy. Why'd you think I want to see you?
Like I said, I did it for my mom. And if I was you, I wouldn't talk about my daddy that way.
If you were me, I think you would.
Have you ever used a voice coach to help you with regional sounds?
I have some. I've had voice coaches on certain things for English accents. I had when I played Eisenhower, I had one. But like, for instance, when I played with Richard Harris, when I played the old Cuban guy, I put three guys on tapes that were Cuban. And I did it myself, listened to those tapes. And for instance, for this part, Earl, in this movie, I just kind of went with my instincts. The writing was so good. Sometimes I have used voice coaches, but other times, no. Sometimes they can get in the way, and sometimes they certainly do help.
Mm-hmm. So your father was in the military, in the Navy,
yes.
I believe?
Yes, he was.
He was an admiral?
Well, he retired as a rear admiral. His active rank was captain. He went to the Naval Academy when he was 16 years old and graduated in the class of 1924. He came off, you know, a farm in Virginia and went to one of those one-room country schools down in the woods, and then graduated. He went to high school when he was 11. And, you know, he went to the Naval, he waited a year, and he went to the Naval Academy when he was 16. So it was all, he was a career naval officer. He was 39 during the war, the youngest captain in the Navy. He was in destroyers and so forth, but he was a career naval officer.
I bet your father didn't want anyone to think that he was the character in The Great Santini.
Well, he is not, well, kind of. Actually, my father was a lot quieter than that, so that character was a little more boisterous, and there was some. Let me put it this way: in the book *The Great Santini*, it said there's an imperceptible passing of the mantle of the husband to the wife, of the wife to the husband when the husband comes off of duty and is at home for a while. When he takes over the family, there was no transference in my family. My mother ran it at all times.
Oh, really?
Yes, she did.
Robert Duvall is my guest, and he's starring in the new film *Family Thing*. It's interesting, you know, the Godfather films are such like operatic movies with, you know, people playing gangsters who are given to grand displays of emotion and violence. And you're the one in the movie, the legal advisor, whose job is to advise, to be discreet, to tone everything down.
Right.
So in a way, you're playing a very opposite type of personality than all the other personalities in the film.
Yeah, well, it was a pretty interesting character in that he was an adopted son plus this legal advisor. So therefore, as an actor and as the character, you really can't cross the line. You're kind of an outsider, but you're not an outsider. I really enjoyed the part. Those first two Godfathers, that's about as good as you can get filmmaking wise, I think.
I agree.
Francis was at top form. Although, as you say, maybe a touch they romanticized the organized crime to a point, but it was such good filmmaking. You can excuse that.
Do you have any favorite scenes in the Godfather films?
Well, there were a lot of them I liked, you know. I mean, the one with Michael Gazzo in Godfather 2, where I have to tell him he has to, slit his wrists. I enjoyed that a lot, that scene. And the scene where I had to tell Brando that Sonny died in Godfather 1, that was nice. And there were other scenes I liked a lot, too, but those kind of come to mind very quickly.
My wife is crying upstairs. I hear cars coming to the house. Consigliere Minor, I think you should tell your Don what everyone seems to know.
I didn't tell Mama anything. I was about to come up and wake you just now and tell you.
But you needed a drink first.
Yeah.
And now you've had your drink.
They shot Sonny on the causeway. He's dead.
Now, you worked with Francis Ford Coppola again on Apocalypse Now.
Right, right.
And in Apocalypse Now, you were Colonel Kilgore,
right.
Famous for the line...
But I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Is that the one?
That's
smells
the one.
Like victory, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a wonderful line. People come up to me and quote it to me as and say it like it's such an in thing between just me and them, and like it's like they're the only ones that ever thought of it. But that happens with everybody the same way.
Did you get the script and say, well, first of all, was that line in the script, or is that something that you?
Yeah, no, that was in there, and I think the part was offered to somebody else, and they turned it down, And I said to Francis, I know that the part's written for a bigger guy, real tall, big guy, rugged. But, you know, I'll just say once, I think maybe I could do the part, and I'll put in my plea. And he gave it to me. So it was enjoyable. It was a lovely part, and I enjoyed playing it very much.
You smell that? You smell that? Napalm, son. Nothing else in the world smells like that. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb for 12 hours. When it was all over, I walked up. We didn't find one of them, not one stinking dink body. The smell, you know, that gasoline smell. The whole hill. Smelled like victory.
So when you saw the line in the film, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning," did you say to yourself, "A classic line, people will be repeating this back to me"?
No, I didn't. I didn't think of that. I didn't think of it that way. I wasn't sure. You know, I mean, sometimes you're not so aware of that. Although you like lines like that.
Did you do a lot of different line readings on that? I love the smell of napalm. I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
The one that was most predominant, there was Jimmy Keene, a friend of mine who played a small part in that from Buffalo. I made him call me Mr. Duvall for a year because that was a relationship in the movie because, you know, but we're all on a first-name basis. But he's saying, now, how do you do this? And he was watching me. And he did great imitation. We were always doing imitation. So the final dress rehearsal before we filmed, we were always doing Brando imitation. So I said, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. I paused and I said, smells like victory. I did my Brando, and he couldn't believe that I would do that, you know. So then he began doing Brando imitations. So then when Brando wanted $100,000 to do six lines of the censored stuff for the censored version of the TV version of The Godfather, and they wouldn't pay him, they got Jimmy Keene from Buffalo for $200 to do Brando.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So those imitations started in the Philippines, and Jimmy got, because of those imitations, blossomed into the guy that would do the censored version for Brando.
Hey, they could have saved a lot of trouble with Brando and Apocalypse Now, I guess.
I suppose, yeah. Well, Jimmy was the guy that was there that told me all these wild stories after I left. See, I did the second half of my part first, and then 6 months later came back and did the first half. It was strange the way I had to go do another job because they got so bogged down with weather and with different actors and approaches and so forth. It took a long time to complete that film.
It must have been really different working with Coppola on the Godfather movies than working with him on Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, well, you see, I had worked with Francis in The Rain People, as I had said.
And that was in the late 60s.
Kind of a moody guy, and I didn't quite get a handle on Francis. But then I gained a tremendous amount of respect for him because on Godfather 1, we started out, I said, okay, this is Francis again. He's not saying much. A little moody, you know, the way he is. He never comes out. I want to write a book someday called The Rushes Are Great because everybody protects everybody by saying The Rushes Are Great. Francis is one of the only guys that comes out of the cutting room with a long face, and maybe that's why he's so good in that he isn't always thrilled, you know. But I gained a lot of respect for him because in Godfather 1, physically, they had an understudy director following him around in case he failed to fire him and take over. And he worked under that pressure. I don't know how you would do that with a guy physically, like, over your shoulder in case we... And I think the first AD was the best friend of that would-be hopeful director. That's quite a lousy thing to do to a director, and I gained a lot of respect for Francis for working under that pressure.
When you were young, Brando was one of your heroes, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was quite a phenom. I mean, there were others too, but then you grow away from somebody's influence and find your own way.
So what was it like to work with him when he was much older? He'd physically changed. It wasn't, I think, a particularly good period for him.
Well, no, in The Godfather, he was very
in Godfather,
rather
great,
trim.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right, right, right. But
and
in
when
Apocalypse,
I first worked
I'm
with
thinking.
Him, in, well, Apocalypse. Yeah, I wasn't really there when he worked.
Right.
I worked with him first in The Chase way back, and you know, the first day he called me into his dressing room and we talked about the part. I said, "Oh, to my wife, this is going to be great. We're going to be like brother. We had a great rapport." Then he never spoke to me again for 8 weeks. I wasn't quite used to that lifestyle of somebody not speaking to you at the beginning of a day. But that's the way he is, I guess. But no, I was respectful and admired him and enjoyed working with him. And as I say in Apocalypse Now, that he came into the jungle with his baby blue Mercedes driving down the jungle, you know, after I had left. And then when I came back, he'd finished, you know.
So tell me, when you were young and getting started in acting, what were your expectations? What did you think would come of your career?
Well, maybe I was innocent, and maybe innocence not the same as naive. Maybe it is. I always felt that somehow I would fit in. I went to New York feeling I would be a stage actor. I didn't think a lot about movies. I thought about them, but I wasn't sure. I just figured I was going to work. I didn't know how, but I figured it would happen. And when I got one of the worst reviews anybody could ever get, I went back to Virginia for a while, and then I came back again. My friend Udo Grossbard, then we had done A View from the Bridge, and we did it again off-Broadway, and it was a wonderful production with John Voight. Dusty Hoffman was assistant stage manager, Susan Ansbach, Ray Bieri, you know, Richie Castellano. It was a wonderful production. That helped launch my more into film and TV, you know.
So if you don't mind my asking, what did that terrible review say
I'm going to tell you exactly what it said.
You still remember.
It said, Shaw has invented some impossible young men in his plays, but never one so revolting as the romantic young interest in this one. And the character is made even less palatable by Robert Duvall, whose spine tends toward a figure S, whose diction is flannel-coated, and whose simpering expressions are moronic. Now, that's a pretty bad review.
Yeah.
And the other paper likened me to Liberace, so I had to get off the bus.
Liberace?
Yeah, I had to get off the bus. I was physically ill.
What was the connection to Liberace?
I don't know. Maybe I played him a little of Feeder. I don't know what it was. It was it was a guy from the Actors Studio. I don't know. He had us lying down doing Sense Memory before we were doing George Bernard Shaw. I said, we should be telling jokes, not lying on the floor for Sense Memory. It was the whole approach was wrong. It was a disaster. But, you know, at least it was an experience, at least.
Well, Robert Duvall, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Robert Duvall stars in the new movie, A Family Thing. This is Fresh Air. I found Duvall's story about the bad review really amusing, and it made me think, what kind of review would you give to Fresh Air? When you pledge your support, that's a good review that really counts. Your pledge is what this station needs to keep us on the air, and it sends the message that you want to hear Fresh Air in the future. Thank you for your support of Fresh Air and Public Radio. Pioneer rock and roll disc jockey Alan Freed called his radio show The Big Beat because he knew that the beat was what drew kids to rock and roll. In the first of a series that examines the instruments of rock and roll, Ed Ward traces the history of the drum, which underlies everything.
There's a single thing that defines American popular music, it's the beat. The beat is what sets our music apart from the European tradition, what gives it its immediacy and appeal, and in times when the culture is changing, makes it controversial. Once upon a time, of course, European music had a beat. In medieval and Renaissance dance music, various percussion instruments were used to keep time, but eventually, except in the most primitive folk music, the pulse was internalized. You were expected to keep time yourself. By the time European folk music came to these shores, percussion was long gone. Enter the Africans, to whom drumming was both a social event and a means of communication. The story of the banning of drums from New Orleans' Congo Square to prevent incitement to slave revolt is well known by now, and as the black musical tradition developed in the 19th century, drumming was relegated to parades. But even there, one precious gift from Africa remained, syncopation. Early recordings don't feature drums, even though bands used them. Recording technology couldn't handle them, and drummers hit tuned wood blocks to show what they meant to play. But from the beginning, the unique African-American fingerprint was in the music, accentuating the second and fourth beats. 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4. And then delaying these accents minutely to make it swing.
I want a little girl to love a lot. I'd give her anything that I've got for just a little girl to fall in love with me. I want a little girl.
This is where rock and roll comes into the picture. The gentle nudge of swing was beginning to seem unsuited for modern times by the mid-50s. Something stronger was called for. Down in New Orleans, they had it.
Gonna tell Aunt Mary about Uncle John. He claimed he has a misery, but he's having a lot of fun. Oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. Having me some fun tonight. Yeah. Well, long tall Sally, she bibble speech, she got everything that Uncle John need. Oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. Having me some fun tonight. Yeah. Well, a song Uncle John with...
Earl Palmer could drum in a number of styles, but his putting the 2 and 4 squarely on the beat on Little Richard's first records makes him the father of rock and roll drumming. It was a technique that soon spread.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
The big beat, that was what set rock and roll apart from the past. As Chuck Berry said, it has a backbeat. You can't lose it. Moralists said it was driving teenagers into sexual frenzy. Of course, they'd said the same thing about the waltz in Johann Strauss's day. But let's face it, most rock and roll drumming as music is pretty monotonous. That's the point, of course, but it's also why people assumed Ringo wasn't as bright as John or Paul.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day. And I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend.
Still, there was artistry to be found. Be it in jazz-trained Charlie Watts' minimalist drumming for the Rolling Stones, the freneticism of The Who's Keith Moon, or the complexity of another jazz fan, Mitch Mitchell, in the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
I heard some you got your families living in cages, tall and cold. Some just stay there and dust away past the age of old.
One factor keeping the drummer back was the lack of dynamics in so much rock and roll. It all stayed on one level. This was less of a problem in soul music, though, where masters like Al Jackson Jr. redefined swing in a rock-style context. The 70s saw some new ingredients thrown into the pot. Reggae loosened up the concept of the beat tremendously, with drummers like Carlton Barrett of the Wailers and Sly Dunbar showing a whole new way to play. On the other hand, there was the rhythm machine, used in such hits as Timmy Thomas's Why Can't We Live Together? As the machines improved in sophistication, good use was made of them. Today, machines play a strong part in the rhythms of popular music, although they're apt to be playing samples of real drummers like Led Zeppelin's John Bonham or one of James Brown's drummers. Whatever the source, though, the big beat is alive and well.
Writer Ed Ward is now living in Berlin. Tomorrow, Ed looks at the bass in rock and roll. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a lesson in film editing and sound design from Walter Murch. He won an Academy Award for his sound design of Apocalypse Now. Other films he's edited or mixed are The Godfather Trilogy, The Conversation, American Graffiti, Ghost, and Crumb.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Father Goose, One Man, A Gaggle of Geese, and Their Real-Life Incredible Journey South by William Lishman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walter Murch is a film editor and sound designer. He's learned that subtle differences can make a big difference in the impact a film has on the viewer. For instance, 25 years ago, for the final scene of The Godfather, when Michael Corleone closes the door on his wife to signify he's now working for the family, Murch recorded all the doors in director Francis Ford Coppola's house, listening for the door slam that would have the sound of betrayal.
That Corleone.
Walter Murch won an Academy Award for his sound design of Apocalypse Now. He also mixed and or edited The Conversation, Julia, Ghost, and Crumb. His new book, The Blink of an Eye, is about film editing. Murch says when it comes to editing conversation, he often paces the cuts according to the rhythm of the character's eye blinks.
This was something I came across almost by accident, a fortuitous accident, when I was editing a film called The Conversation, which came out 25 years or so ago. And Gene Hackman was the star of the film, who's a very accomplished actor. And I noticed that there was a strange alignment between the places that I would choose to cut the film and where the Gene Hackman actor playing this character would blink. Most of the time, an actor just has an involuntary control of when you blink. You're in the moment, and blinking is a very subconscious thing. But it was uncanny that there was this alignment. So I began thinking about it and just started to watch people in ordinary situations blinking. And I began to notice quite soon that there was a very complex, interesting relationship between where people blink and what they're saying, and even more so, what they might be thinking. What you're told in high school biology is that the blink is a device that we have developed to moisten the surface of the eye, and it certainly accomplishes this. But if that were the complete truth, then anyone entering a certain environment would set upon a certain rate of blinking that would remain constant while they were in that environment. In fact, this doesn't happen. You see people who blink repeatedly when they're nervous. You can see people who are enraged who stop blinking entirely. In a strange sense, I found myself able to gauge my own tendency to blink and then somehow reroute that so that I would push the edit button whenever I wanted to blink. And this seemed to produce the most effective places to cut.
How often do you find yourself using that as a technique for pacing? All the time.
All the time. It's a daily thing.
But this is a curious thing. Like, if you're cutting at just the moment, say, I'm ready to blink while watching a scene, would I miss the edit because I was blinking when it happened?
Effectively, you do. And that's one of the things that makes it smooth. If you think about it, film editing is a very violent thing, as I said earlier. It's you're putting people into a situation where they're watching a visual field, which is interesting and complex, and then in a so-called blink of an eye, you remove that entire visual field and replace it with something else. Now, this doesn't represent anything that we have happened to us in our daily lives. When you wake up in the morning, what you see for the rest of the day is one continuous shot, so to speak. You can turn your head from side to side, but there's all this intervening material in between. So the fact that cutting a film actually works, that people can look at a film and make sense of it, is actually kind of amazing.
Now, Walter Murch, you've also done a lot of sound design for films as well as editing the films.
Yes.
I want to talk with you a little bit about sound. And I know when you're doing a movie, if you just record the real sound of a situation, it sometimes doesn't sound quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to fake it. You have to, like, recreate it in a more convincing way. So let's hear some of the ways that you've made sound very convincing, or how you've used sound to create a psychological
Sure.
effect. You've brought some scenes with you. What's the first scene that you brought? What should we listen
first,
for
first
here?
First scene is from the Godfather, and the sound that was recorded for this scene, which is where Michael kills Sollozzo. It's the first time that he's actually...
This is Al Pacino as Michael Corleone.
Al Pacino, right. He's acting on behalf of the family, which is something he's tried not to do up to this point. So it's a big turning point for him. The sound that was recorded for this scene was absolutely fine. Francis wanted to hold off on having music. Nonetheless, he wanted something to add a tension to the scene to show what was going on inside Michael. So why don't we listen to the scene, and then I'll talk about what happened.
Great.
Tu padre sta male.
Quando tu sta meglio? Il cane ti fa un più ognuno. E mettiamo tutto a posto. Sti fissaria, si deve finire.
Okay, Walter Murch, what are you doing there?
Well, what you're looking at in that scene is just two people talking in a relatively abandoned restaurant. What you're hearing, especially leading up to the moment that he pulls the trigger, is a very loud sound of an elevated train going around a corner. Nothing in the scene up to this point has indicated that the trains are anywhere in the neighborhood. It takes place in the Bronx in the late 40s, so you're, I guess, allowed to think that such trains would be in the neighborhood, but you haven't seen anything like that. And nothing, visually speaking, allows you to think that anything like that would be so loud if you did hear it. So that you're presented with a equivalency between what you're looking at and what you're hearing, which doesn't quite add up. It's just a close-up of Michael Corleone, and yet there's this loud screeching sound on the track. When something doesn't add up, the mind of the audience is always anxious to make it add up. And if you can find just the right amount of distance between what you see and what you hear, they will incorporate that distance into something that is related to what they're looking at. In this case, that screeching somehow is a reflection of what's going on inside Michael. So in a strange way, people don't hear that screech. What they see instead is a man making up his mind to kill somebody. So in a weird way, that screeching is kind of the neurons in Michael Corleone's mind just before the moment that he says, "I will do it."
My guest is film editor and sound designer Walter Murch. His new book on editing is called In the Blink of an Eye. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film sound designer and visual editor Walter Murch. Now, you also did the sound for Apocalypse Now. You worked on the sound for Apocalypse Now. And you've brought a scene from that movie to demonstrate what you did. Maybe you could set up the scene for us.
Okay. This is at the beginning of the film, and the Willard character, who's played by Martin Sheen, is cooped up in a hotel room in Saigon. He's found that there's no place in the world for him other than Vietnam. He's tried to go home. He can't. And yet he's stuck in this hotel room, and they won't give him a mission. They won't let him go out into the jungle. So it's a scene of a man stewing in his own juices. What we're looking at is this images of a man trying to pass the time in a hotel room. What you're going to hear is a transition from the street sounds of Saigon to the sounds of the jungle. So that visually, there's a discontinuity again. It's a little bit like the screeching train and Michael Corleone's murder. They don't quite add up. You're looking at a man in a hotel room, but you're hearing jungle sounds. And so there's a fruitful discontinuity there that allows you to get inside the character's head.
Let's hear it.
Saigon. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm gonna wake up back in the jungle, when I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and there'd be nothing. I hardly said a word to my wife until I said yes to a divorce. When I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle. I'm here a week now, waiting for a mission, getting softer. Every minute I stay in this room, I get weaker. And every minute Charlie squats in the bush, he gets stronger. Each time I looked around, the walls moved in a little tighter.
Very nice. Now, did you record Martin Sheen's voice also?
Yes, yeah.
What were you looking for? There's a kind of a very interior monologue sound to the way his voice is recorded. I think you probably recorded that differently than if he was actually having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, no, the microphone was, we moved it as close as physically possible to him and then asked him to almost whisper.
Mm-hmm.
So that it gives an interior quality to it, that conventional narration, which has a sort of a documentary film feel, would not have. We wanted at all costs to avoid that and to give you some way to get inside the head of this character.
Would it be fair to say that the film you spent the most time editing was Apocalypse Now?
Absolutely, yes. I was a junior partner on that film, and I was editing picture for a year and then worked on the soundtrack for a year. But there were people who'd been on the film for 3 years. Francis, of course, had been on it from the beginning, and that was, I think, 5 years in his case.
How much footage did you have to edit in Apocalypse Now? Can you give us a sense of how many feet or how many hours worth? How about how many hours worth? That would probably be more meaningful.
Well, the film is just under 2.5 hours long, and there were just under 250 hours of material.
Wow.
So it's roughly 100 hours of material for every hour that made it on the screen. So it's actually amazing that we finished it as quickly as we did.
There must have been hundreds of other stories you could have told with that footage. Did you find yourself shaping the story as you were editing?
Yeah. It's there are a few scenes that were shot that are not in the film. Mostly toward the end of the film. But the script, if you can get a hold of the script, the original script, it's actually not that far from the eventual result.
So why was there so much footage?
Partly the technique by which they filmed the battles. They would load up cameras of... with a 10-minute load of film and have 8 cameras positioned simultaneously and then simply let loose this gigantic complex machinery of a battle. And it was actually like a battle was taking place in front of your eyes. If you happened to be standing there, you would be less aware of cameras than of there's a battle going on. So it was documentary in a sense. And any documentary has a very large shooting ratio. So there was a high documentary component to Apocalypse Now, where fortuitous things would happen and you would capture those things. But in order to increase the your chances of getting something fortuitous, you had to generate a lot of footage to do that.
Could you see the difference between takes? I mean, was it always clear to you which take was the best take?
Well, that's a it's a funny question, because what is good in one context is not good in another. So you have to, when you're putting a film together, you have to both create the context and choose things that will fit into that context. It's a little bit like lifting yourself up by your bootstraps. And that's, if there's a mystery to film editing, it's probably that. You probably put your finger right on it. What is good? And what is good is not always obvious. I wish it were. It would make our life simpler. But things that you look at, that part of you says, oh, that's not very good. Another part of you says, but you know, in this context, it actually might be great. You know, some little... there's a scene in a scene where they're briefing Willard on his mission.
In Apocalypse Now.
In Apocalypse Now. And the Harrison Ford character, the trick of that scene was that Francis told the operator to, operator of the camera, to go wherever he wanted, not to be... swayed by whatever anyone was saying. So none of the actors knew when the camera was going to be on them or off them. And there's one scene where Harrison Ford, as an actor, is looking at the camera trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? But the stare that he gives the camera, and he's looking right into the camera at that point, has an unnerving, actually a wonderful effect, which is it reads as a look to Martin Sheen, a look to Willard that says, we're in a very deep situation here, and I have to play this game by the rules, but I hope you have a lot of luck out there, soldier. So you read a tremendous amount into that look, although the look itself was simply Harrison Ford as an actor trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? So, you know, it's one of the rules of film editing, of never have the actors look into the camera. Here, that rule is violated, so it's technically a mistake, but within the context of the scene, which is one of a building up paranoia, it actually fits very well.
Walter Murch, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, you too. Thank you very much, Terry.
Walter Murch's new book is called In the Blink of an Eye, A Perspective on Film Editing. This is Fresh Air. All of us who work on Fresh Air love movies. We bring you interviews not just with the actors who we see on the screen, but with the behind-the-scenes figures who are not nearly as well-known or appreciated. By telling us about his adventures in editing and sound design, Walter Murch helps us understand not only how a film is made, but how it works on us. This is the kind of discussion you've come to expect from Fresh Air and from public radio. And you know what it takes to keep it all going. Your pledge during this fundraiser. Thank you for your support. Over the weekend, NBC's Saturday Night Live did battle for the first time with its newest late-night comedy show competitor, Saturday Night Special on Fox. One of the executive producers of Saturday Night Special is Roseanne, who also hosted Saturday's inaugural installment. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Roseanne opened her new show by addressing the TV audience directly the way Jack Benny used to do. Jack Benny was a TV pioneer. Almost half a century later, Roseanne wants to be one too.
Hello. I'm Roseanne. Thank you for tuning in. Tonight, I'm taking on a new challenge, but I cannot do it alone. Let's be pioneers in television together. I'm asking you to trust me, to take my hand and venture with me into uncharted waters.
I was ready to do my part as a TV pioneer Saturday night. I was there and watching. But in this first edition of Saturday Night Special, Roseanne wasn't blazing a trail. She was stumbling down a path that was well-worn, but, in this case, not at all well-written. Saturday Night Special, like Saturday Night Live, has a guest host, a core of regular performers, lots of skits, and some quickie filler pieces. The major difference in the premiere was that Roseanne's show had two musical guests instead of one, and had special guest stars as well. On Saturday, those hotly promoted guest stars included Sharon Stone and Party of Five star Scott Wolf. But all they did was show up to introduce the musical guests, then disappear. It was a bait-and-switch tactic, as close as you can get to false advertising without actually lying. So how did the two shows compare? As Roseanne promised before her new series premiered, Saturday Night Special featured its female cast members more prominently than Saturday Night Live did. More prominently, but not necessarily more humorously. In that respect, the incumbent beat the challenger easily. And with Steve Forbes as guest host, it wasn't even one of Saturday Night Live's better installments. Both shows, by coincidence, had skits featuring humans dressed as flies and other sketches built around military drill instructors. More predictably, both shows did sketches about the Unabomber. SNL cast Will Ferrell in the role of suspected bomber Theodore Kaczynski and had him attending his high school reunion with revenge on his mind while in FBI custody. SNS, if we should call it that, had a court TV spoof with guest analyst O.J. Simpson, played by Warren Hutcherson, predicting the Unabomber suspect would walk.
All they have is a bunch of circumstantial evidence probably planted by a policeman who hates Polish people.
And that was the best line in the entire 60 minutes of Saturday Night Special, although it wasn't the best skit. It was also bland there was no best skit, even though Saturday Night Special tried hard to be outrageous. One segment featured four women in bikinis mud wrestling to a Beastie Boys song, and another featured Roseanne imitating Demi Moore and making fun of Moore's surgically enhanced appearance. Excuse me, but isn't Roseanne making fun of someone else for having plastic surgery a little like Michael Jackson doing it? Saturday Night Special does fulfill one useful function, though. When it ends its spring run at the end of May and returns the time slot to Mad TV, that other Fox variety show will look a lot better by comparison. In fact, I miss it already.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Steve Earle made his biggest impact in 1986 when he released his widely praised debut album, Guitar Town. Since then, Earle has put out a series of more uneven collections and had various scrapes with the law, culminating in a 1994 arrest for possession of heroin. But last year, Earle put out an acoustic country album called Train A-Comin'. He contributed a track to the Dead Men Walking soundtrack, and he has a new rock and roll record whose title sums him up now. It's called I Feel All Right. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I was born with my papa's son wandering out and a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel all right. I feel all right tonight. I feel all right. I feel all right tonight.
For a while there, it looked as if Steve Earle's reputation as a bad boy and screw-up would overshadow his work as a fine purveyor of articulate country rock. Like so many rock and rollers who've done jail time, Earle has a propensity for both self-pity and self-mythologizing. From song to song, he might be a noble loser, a hapless victim, or a lonely man of honor. I like him best when he's sounding like a honky-tonk Buddy Holly or a one-man Everly Brothers on a track like Poor Boy.
Everybody over here just put me down. I never thought about it much till the first time I saw you. Uh-oh, what's a poor boy gonna do?
Steve Earle is a throwback to the singer-songwriters of the 70s. Raised in Texas with an emotional affinity for Willie Nelson's so-called outlaw country movement, Earl makes every drawl a declaration of artistic intent. On a mediocre cut on this album such as Billy and Bonnie, Earl sounds like he's doing a John Mellencamp impersonation. At other times, his reedy growl and wheezy phrasing remind me of John Prine. Earl is best when he's delivering a song most straightforwardly, selling the melody with brisk energy, as he does on More Than I Can Do.
I'm trying hard to let you go, but it's more than I can do. And every day or two, I wind up right back where I started. I'm trying not to let you know that I'm still in love with you. I can't just sit home blue, 'cause there ain't no rest for the broken hearted. Just because you wanna unlock your door, that don't mean you don't love me anymore. So I'm never gonna let you go, no matter what you do, because you know it's more than I can do.
Earl tells a story that when he was in jail for drug possession, another inmate stole his radio. He was getting ready to go beat up the thief when a friend stopped him and said, "You're going to do your little time, and then you're going to get out of here, and you're going to make me a nice record." Apparently, for once in his life, Steve Earle heard some good advice and took it.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Steve Earle's new CD, I Feel All Right. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.